Ah, that saxophonist, clarinetist, arranger, composer, and band leader, Oliver Nelson, and some incredible sidemen with Screamin' the Blues, the title track of his 1961 album. Oliver Nelson, as I said, is on tenor and alto sax on this album, as we have Richard Williams on trumpet, Eric Dolphy on alto sax and bass clarinet. We have Richard Wyons on piano, George Duvivier on bass, and Roy Haynes, one of my very, very favorite drummers. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, today we had discussed setting aside for some kind of wrap-up, if you will, of questions that you have pertaining to the Clinton Foundation and the state of the economy, and how do we get ourselves, or are we getting ourselves, as we are supposed to be, ready for a very disappointing economic forecast, and doing so in a way that we remember that the number one objective is survival. People will put it in different terms that, you ought to just remain calm and, things are getting better. Actually, they're not. They're getting better if you're rich, but they're not getting better if you one of the flock. And we have to think of different ways and different attitudes to adopt different approaches that we should take around the number one imperative. And don't forget it, it's your survival. The madness that is going on now will continue to go on because these are crazy people. And when I say that, I mean we really have to understand the politics that we are experiencing. We have a shift in power that we haven't seen in a long time, or if ever, of across the board chaotic behavior, ruthless individualism, ruthless. I just want what's mine. That's why I want to be elected. And now that I'm elected, I'm taking what I want, how I want, when I want. It's a kind of political gangsterism. And in the meantime, we don't have very much of a counter against it. Yeah, we have some things that we can do, but those things require time. And so the challenge for us in the immediate future is to devise our own way. If there is merit in coming together with other folks, if they're okay to get together with, fine. But we should economize our efforts and use time to our best advantage. When I say economize our efforts, I mean don't throw good energy after a losing proposition. And begin the process of getting intensely involved with crafting your own survival methods. That is very, very important. And then, when we see that there is enough of a coalescence of like minds to forge a sensible opposition, not an opposition for opposition's sake, a sensible opposition, then we'll see where we go with that. But don't forget, all the while, no matter what we're hearing, trust that most of what we're hearing is propaganda. It is to sway our minds to one position or another, but it really has nothing to do with our benefit. It still is about them, all of them, winning. And then when they win, it automatically means we lose. So don't get too emotional. Get methodical, and we will pull through. But we also will have the advantage of understanding more thoroughly this system that we're living in and what we have to do in terms of our politics, our ways of life and thinking, our inspection of how we live in this world. What's the best way to live in this world? And that's a gradual process, but we've run out of time this cycle, I think. We've run out of time significantly to get involved in very, very mass movements unless they're spectacularly large movements and well thought out, well guided, sensible, practical, pragmatic. I don't see that happening on a mass level. It's happening in pockets. And even so, it is happening in reaction. We're not being proactive. We're constantly reacting to the craziness out here. And part of the power that we ought to have is to set the tone and set the direction of our power. So we will talk a little bit about that, but mostly what I wanted to do was to follow through with your requests to have a one-on-one with Charles Ortel, dealing with the questions he had raised, had answered, and the questions you had raised some time ago, once he had presented this idea that what we're being told about the economy and so forth, just is not true. And to head off the big bad surprise, you know, when it can't be held off anymore, by then we will be in desperate trouble. We'll be in dire straits. So we'll be talking about that today, and we'll take your questions about the information shared most recently, the updates about the Clinton Foundation and related issues. That number is 888-874-4888. To use the time profitably, please have a question and stay on point. Okay, but Charles, first of all, thank you for being here. You are here, aren't you?
I believe so. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much. Before we get into the questions, the solid part of the program, what is going on between yesterday and today that we talked that is of importance to the subject that we raised yesterday, further advancing our knowledge of what's happening with the Clintons and related issues? If you could give us a fast overview.
Sure. So a couple of things. This morning we learned that our brothers and sisters in Canada are allowing a leader, some affectionately referred to as Justin Trudeau, to go ahead and give a lot of money to the Clinton Foundation now in 2017, knowing everything that that government has to know about the Clinton Foundation's sordid history since October 23, 1997, and with all its pressing problems occasioned by lower energy prices that are a real drag on the Canadian resource-based economy, this young prime minister has decided it's a good idea, you know, to just basically buck the tide and go and not do what other nations around the world are doing and just cutting off funds to this fraud, but to turn around and give it more money. And the amounts I read, I haven't verified, are $241 million over a period of years. So, I mean, this guy is clearly a loon. So that's one development. The second development is our team has been doing some more digging into some narrow technicalities. And with the revelations overnight that, you know, this whole, it was Donald Trump Jr., ensnared or willingly part of a plot to maybe try to buy these emails or get these emails, we've learned that this Russian, in quotes, lawyer is somebody who, you know, may or may not actually be a real lawyer and got in this country on the basis of what looks to me anyway to be false pretenses in a move orchestrated while I believe Comey was still FBI director and while Loretta Lynch was our attorney general. This person was given a special dispensation to come into the country and get involved in a negotiation where someone connected to her, a rich oligarch, who was under an investigation, it appears, for money laundering, in the hundreds of millions, was let off with a $6 million fine. I mean, that just reeks to me. And going back to the technicals, we've had a team looking, real experts, to, you know, take a hard look at the fine details surrounding the Clinton Foundation filings, federal, state, foreign. And back in 2002, there was a critical moment. 2002 is an interesting period because James Comey was the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, leading an investigation into public corruption at, with the Clinton Foundation, with Bill Clinton, had teams of agents, teams of Justice Department people involved, and a grand jury and panel. And they should have been able to see what is apparent from the public filings that that this supposed type of charity, which needed to be not controlled by an inside board of political hacks, including Terry McAuliffe, the ultimate chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and other Clinton loyalists, this thing was supposed to be controlled by a representative sample of the public. And it was supposed to only get at least a third of its support from small donors and governments. And when you look at the details in these forms, what you see clearly is that the Clinton Foundation, unless, of course, they're lying, said in their forms that they had, during this entire period, no donations of any time from government donors. So that would rule out one crucial normal support stream for this type of charity. And then when you look at their declarations concerning all their other donors, there are restrictions placed on how much come from the big donors. And I haven't reached the conclusion yet, but it seems likely to me that it's mathematically impossible that with the declarations made to the IRS at this time frame, that this could have qualified for the authority it did receive under the direction of our friend Lois Lerner. So, I mean, this thing reeks.
This is at the IRS.
Right. Who was at the IRS then? But the point is that the team that was looking into this back then in 2002 was Robert Mueller, James Comey, looking at the Clinton Foundation from the inside, being able to see stuff I can't see yet, but we will see, I hope. And they could reach the obvious conclusion that this was a fraud and cut it off. So, you know, there's a tangled web here, and a lot of people, I think, have dirty fingers, more than dirty fingers. I think they're dirt up to their necks. And, you know, meanwhile, Trump is on this trip over to France. I actually have had the pleasure, thanks to a good friend, of dining at the restaurant where he will be momentarily, called Jules Verne. It's on the top of the Eiffel Tower. It's actually a very beautiful restaurant. It's been a scene for many movies, I think, including Rush Hour, one of the Rush Hour flicks. I forget if it was two or not. But it's, you know, a beautiful place. And I hope over dinner, I don't know if he'll do it over, well, he doesn't drink, but over, you know, the main course or the soup course or the dessert course, I hope that Donald Trump, you know, either gets Melania to ask the question in her fluent French or himself ask the question of, well, why is the deficit-plagued French government that is now going to have to stump up and pay its fair share of NATO, you know, going well above its current level, up to 2% and up, why is this cash-strapped French government so willing to look the other way as hundreds of millions of dollars, indeed billions of dollars, went into something called Unitaid and from there into an illegally organized, never validly approved fake charity that did a lot of damage, in my view, around the world in fear, pretending that it fights HIV/AIDS? And I hope this conversation comes up over dinner, but, you know, hope springs eternal, I guess, and you know, maybe we're out of hope at this point.
Okay, well, we have our first caller, Maat, you on the air, Maat from New York. You're on the air,
yes,
with Charles Ortel.
Yes, thank you, Utrice, Charles. Greetings to our beloved PRN and whole family.
Thank you.
My question is on the survival aspect of it and our present realities. I'm talking to Charles as a financial consultant, and I'd like to have some follow-up via, I imagine his site will have perhaps an email. I'm talking about a sister who is an inventor. She has both, you could categorize it, commercial and non-commercial ideas. And the non-commercial ideas are two that could be particularly helpful to humanity overall, in if not immediately, within, say, 50 years. And the problem is she's a Gemini, and so she tends to work on 30 different projects at a time and be a bit too scattered, trying to get some laser focus. But also, there's a problem in terms of Black people have had a whole history in this country over centuries, and it's hard to bring people together and form a circle of support. It has a lot to do with people just on survival mode. But I'd like your ideas, and of course, trying to find a good attorney. Attorneys is so crucial in terms of protecting intellectual property, not necessarily always through a patent, but through trade secret is sometimes much better. So I'm on pins and needles for your answer. You might need to think about some of it, but I hope I can email on you it too.
Okay. Well, let me try to give you a quick answer. I mean, first of all, I don't actually provide advice, particular financial advice to people. You need, you know, to do that properly, you need to be licensed, and I'm not really in that business now, though I was in the past. I'm more speaking generally about macroeconomic conditions and what, you know, people can do generally, as opposed to a specific investment idea. But in this environment right now, you know, there's some good news and the bad news. The good news is I think our government is still solvent enough that the truly needy, the people who are relying on government subsidies and government support, really don't have to worry about anything. There is enough wealth in this country to make sure that the truly needy, the bottom half of this country, bottom third, will have the support they need. So there's really, you know, we didn't go haywire here. We're going to go through a correction where people who have been speculating, who've been borrowing too much, who, let's say, took out second and third mortgages on homes that are way overvalued, those type of people are going to have some real problems. But in the end, this correction is not going to be so damaging that, you know, the people who really need our help won't get it. As far as inventions and ideas are concerned generally, this is a moment where the sophisticated investors who support these type of ideas are very cautious and skittish and demand very exacting terms. So the best way to try to get support for an idea like that is typically what's called a family and friends round, where you go around to people you know and who know you, and discuss your potential idea with them. More often than not, what you'll find is that if people you don't think have money to help will have some money to help. And the only final piece of advice I might give as somebody who has done this type of stuff in the past, be realistic about your budget. Don't assume that you can get a lot of stuff done with a small amount of money, and don't ask for an absurd amount of money. But, you know, have a realistic budget. And don't put everything you own into your idea. Make sure that you have reserve money. All projects, all new businesses need more money and for unanticipated requirements. And so those are just general ideas.
Thank you so much for that. Very, very helpful.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks for your call. 888-874-4888. I want to kind of tack on to this Matt's question, Charles, about in this climate, we're inclined to think that if we work really, really hard, we'll succeed. What is the reality to that idea?
Well, You know, it's interesting. I was fortunate in having a loving set of caring parents and also an extended family and some wise, I never met my grandmother or great-grandmother, but some wise older generation types. And I can remember as a young child, my grandfather had a very sunny disposition, giving me advice that I've tried to stick with. And he said at a young age, why don't you try to find something that will make a productive contribution to society? And then if you can get paid for doing that, you'll always be happy because you won't regard what you're doing as work. And that, I think, is the best advice I've gotten from anybody, family or not. Too many people don't have the benefit of you know, the wise older person who can tell you that. There's an array of things that you can try to do. I remember, you know, my mother, who's passed away, was a musician, and she was very good, trained on the piano and pipe organ and cello, and she had this idea that her elder son might make a great pianist. And, you know, I can play chopsticks, but that's about it. And, you know, it got to be, you know, a number of years into piano lessons where I was slaughtering every known piece of music that would be put in front of me. And one day my mother came in after listening to me bang on the piano, and she said, you know, Charles, it's okay. You don't have to be. You could give up trying to be a piano player.
And, please don't be so ambitious.
Yeah, and my youngest brother was even worse on the violin, so we got out of the whole music trade. But the point is that there's a wide array of things that you can try to do. And, you know, some of the people I've met in life who are amazing. I don't know how many people in the audience know master plumbers and master carpenters. People who are really skilled tradespeople are very frequently incredibly intelligent. Chefs. A lot of the people stories I've heard of many different times, different people unrelated to each other, were very difficult students, troubled students in school, and then they learned that they were very talented as chefs, and they went on and they made, you know, fortunes, frankly, in that business. So there's a wide array of things you can consider trying to do. Pick something that you're happy doing. Pick something that you're competent doing. You don't necessarily have to aspire to take on the entire world, but you could try to be really, really good at something productive. And then once you get into it, another piece of advice I got from somebody else is, you know, when you get your first paycheck, pay yourself first. In other words, don't, you know, get into a situation where, I mean, some people unexpectedly or for whatever reason have bills. They start out life with bills they can't pay. But, you know, for the mass of the population, try to start off in your first job. And when you get that check and you see how much gets taken out for Social Security and other taxes, and you look at the net amount that you've earned, you know, put some of it into a savings account. Start that discipline at a young age. And if you start your life off that way and don't fall prey to the idea of, you know, because you get a credit card mailer when you're a student, you've already got student loans, and you start taking out, you know, credit card debts you shouldn't do. Don't go down that path. If you pick something you like to do, pay yourself first out of your first paycheck and every subsequent paycheck. Before long, you will find yourself in a position where you have flexibility and where you can start to be thinking about making investments and participating in that side of life. Sadly, these lessons are not taught. I mean, there used to be something called home economics, you know, decades ago, which then migrated into, you know, how to teach people how to, you know, take care of a house. When you know, the science of how you deal with your personal money is something that, you know, many families don't talk about money. And, you know, rich or poor, they just don't believe you should talk about it. And others don't have frank enough conversations about it. But if you get into that mental mindset early, and you can start teaching kids about this when they're, you know, 5, 6, 7. It's just very useful. It sets you on a course where you can aspire to have financial freedom. And, you know, you're then into a moment of making sensible choices. One of the funniest life experiences I had is I was dating somebody who was working for the Rockefeller family. And there's a special place in Westchester called the Canticle Hills. And I was, it's their, you know, their personal country club where the family members and their guests are allowed to go. And so I got an invitation to have lunch over there. And I'm thinking, it's got to be pretty nice. So we go into the central place where they serve meals. And, you know, I look out, there's an indoor set of tennis courts. But then I look at the walls and it's basically falling down. Plaster's falling off the side. I look out at the, you know, the pool. It's all messy. The building is derelict. And then the lunch comes out, and I'm expecting, you know, at least a soup course and, you know, maybe a steak or something. And out comes, you know, off-brand bag of, you know, not even Lay's potato chips, paper plates, and, you know, stringy hamburgers and these crazy-looking hot dogs with, you know, again, ShopRite ketchup and mustard. And it's not because they're poor. You know, it's just, these are people who could afford to spend outrageous amounts of money on food and stuff, and they don't. So, you know, I another vignette is where I live in here in Manhattan. You know, I go into, it's a nice part of town, and I go into the store across the street, and you see people, you know, because you can tell whether they're paying for cash or not, who really shouldn't be making these awful choices, you know, buying food that's way overpriced, not good for you. I mean, make some simple decisions about how you eat, how you live, how you spend your money, and you'll be set for life. And the money, through the magic of, forget about the stock market, just putting it in the savings account. You know, you will find that before 10 years are up or 15 years are up, suddenly you have enormous financial flexibility. On the other hand, if you unwisely, you know, decide to go to a school that has a poor record for placing people in professional jobs, and you incur all kinds of student debt, you're in for a life of misery.
Speaking of which, this correction in the market that you have been referring to, typically, how do people, how does it impact people?
Well, a couple of ways. So, you know, very few Americans, if very few people around the world, actually have enough money that they are investing in individual stocks, you know, very, very beyond the, you know, whatever stock they may get because they work for a company. So, you know, there are very few people are actually, that's why very few people watch CNBC or Fox Business or whatever, or Bloomberg, because there just aren't that many people who have to directly think about that. On the other hand, you know, when you go to work for a government job or you go to work for a big company and you're still getting a pension, how do you think that pension check gets paid to you? It gets paid to you because somebody is managing that money and likely investing in stocks. So when you have a correction, and we haven't really had a brutal correction in recent history, even the one in 1987, though it was bad on the day, it was down, I think, 20% or so for the two-day period where the stock market crashed. For the full year 1987, on I think most of the indices, the actual index during the year was flat. So you contrast that to the period 1929 to 1933, or worse, I think it was 1873. You know, you can have a period where the value of all securities goes down 50%. And, you know, in such an environment, I think the good news is, for those of us living here in America, that pensioners, most pensioners, you know, small pensioners, will not in the end be hurt that badly. But, you know, people who have $1 billion, people who have $100 million, it's going to hurt. It's going to severely hurt. And there will be people who will be, the people who have, you know, independent money and have been speculating with borrowed money, they're going to be slaughtered. Financially speaking, that is.
Jay from Georgia, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
How are you? I just have a question. It's more than likely irrelevant, but I'm just curious if the gentleman has any idea how this correction might affect developers developing, so-called developing land, you know, removing trees, that sort of thing.
I did. Teresa, I didn't catch the question. Did you?
How would this correction affect people developing land?
Well, land is it depends where. So, if you're a You know, in real estate, obviously the key thing is location, location, location. So if you have land that is arable, that is, the crops can grow on it, that has water or maybe trees on it, and you paid a decent price for it, you're fine. If, on the other hand, you're making a gigantic bet as to where the next Walmart might go, outside a third-tier, you know, town in this country, and you've overpaid for your land, then you're in trouble. So, you know, land is actually, to the extent people invest in things in this country, we invest primarily in real estate and land. I'm very comfortable investing in land, but you have to be careful about it. You have to make sure that you've, you know, that you have clear title to it. You've got to make sure that the environment in which your land is situated is not in a place where the local government is going crazy and is going to put all kinds of stupid taxes that don't make sense on you. But in general, I'm very comfortable thinking about land, assuming you're not borrowing a lot of money to buy it.
Thank you.
Is that it for you, Jay?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
You have any follow-up questions?
I'm just curious if it might discourage people from developing as much as they are. I'm thinking more as far as the environment, destruction of the environment. I'm hoping something would happen to kind of slow the whole thing down, the whole development idea down, you know. But that's just my point of view. So.
All right. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Fair enough.
Thank you for calling in with your question. From Brooklyn, David, you're on the air with Charles Ortel.
Oh, thank you very much. What's on my mind is, what would it take in this country for us to have a national pension system so no matter where you worked, if you were on a wage or a salary, that this pension would follow you anywhere, and it would be not a very small amount like Social Security, which does not pay, I think, what's necessary to live for most people, but a pension system that is adequate for people who get to the point of retirement, which I believe should be somewhere around 55 or 60 years of age. I'm sure that in other countries, they have a better system than the one we have here, where it's not like what's going on here, where I would imagine that most people do not have pensions, especially in the private sector, and it's somewhat more people have pensions in the public sector. But what would it take to change that and make it so that everyone could have a decent retirement?
That's a great question. So where we are now, I think, in 2017 is an unusual period point in that, for the long history, in modern history, wages generally around the world have gone up. And now, with the increased power of technology and machines, and with the brutal fact that the most highly paid people on world scale are living inside countries like ours and in other countries in Germany and the West, we are under, as whether you're rich or poor, if you're working for a salary, your salary is under assault. So anything you do to raise the cost of our already highly paid workers in the private sector and public sector around the world is something we need to think about doing very, very carefully. Encouraging businesses. When I started work in 1980, and I fortunately do have a pension. But I think in the private sector, today, very few people have pensions, and it would be a nice move as part of this tax plan of President Trump's to try to encourage employers, instead of overpaying middle managers and senior managers these multi-million, tens of million dollar packages, to think a little bit more about whether corporations, employers, particularly large employers, shouldn't be encouraged to structure the payments to the people you're talking about so that they will have a pension to supplement their Social Security. I think that is a fair point. And the issue there is a sensible deal to be done here, and I know Mr. President Trump, in theory, likes to do deals, on encouraging, as you say, pensions to be portable or service in one company to be portable to another. There's also a deal to be done on Social Security itself. I'd be very much in favor of lowering the tax rates on Social Security, both for the employer and the employee, but eliminating the cap. That is to say, currently on Social Security, the way it works is if you only, as an employer or employee, pay tax up to a certain level. So the movie stars and the sports stars and the financiers who are making tens and 20 million a year, they're only paying Social Security on 100 and change. If you were to make all of their income subject to Social Security, you could then lower the rate for everybody. And also, I think there are issues of equity to be addressed in the fact that, you know, there are varying life expectancies, and some people who pay into Social Security may be from a group that doesn't have a long life expectancy. So is that a fair deal? You know, so there is some work to be done here, and you raise excellent points, but no solution is going to materialize and have, you know, bite with real effect for less, I would say, than a 5 or 10 year period, as a guess.
Yes,
if I could tack on to your question, David, you asked a question that is more institutional. Is there a way, Charles, that an individual can use the information that you have available to begin to put a personal plan together? David?
Yes. For regular wage earners or salary earners, not to get into the gambling of the stock market, I would think that's like playing roulette. And if you're going to be in there, you stay with index funds. But, you know, that's what I think. The small person gambling in the stock market, I think that's pretty dangerous and risky for one's future.
Right. Well, to answer your question, Yatrice, and yours, David, I think in the old days when you go to a savings bank, a well-capitalized savings bank, and you want to give them $500 or whatever the number is, you would be offered a rate of interest on your savings that was higher than inflation. And you could just put your money in that savings bank, and they were pretty well regulated. You could be sure that, you know, when time came to take it out, you would get an amount back that was bigger than you put in, considering interest. That is where that's the place we need to go back to. And, you know, most textbooks and advisors will tell you, and I'm not giving financial advice, I'm just reciting what I remember from these textbooks, is that you're not really investing or preparing for your future until you have a savings cushion, most people would argue, of at least 6 months of living expense. And 6 months isn't that long in this day and age. It's going to be tough if you suddenly lose your job to find a new job within 6 months. It's not so easy. So, you know, I think it would be a great first step in this country where reports suggest and data suggests that across our 120 million plus households, a tiny fraction of them has $500 in savings. This is a preposterous place to be for a country where, you know, we are, in theory, as rich as we all are. You know, our first goal should be to get 80% of our households to a place where they have 6 months living expenses in cash, not in stocks, in cash. And, you know, when you do the math on that, that's an ambitious ask. So maybe we should settle for a week or a month or 3 months. But I think that's where we start first. And if you could put that cushion together with that together and, you know, continued practices started early, you won't need a per se pension plan or an employer. You will have done the work that these managers, you know, do for the pension plan administrator. you'll have instilled in yourself these, you know, lifelong investing in learning practices and living practices that will give you and the family you may have the cushion you need.
Thanks, David, for your question.
Thank you.
From Peekskill, New York, Rashid, you're on the air. With Charles Ortel. I keep forgetting to say your name, Charles.
That's right. I think the developers, with all this development that's going on, it's got to stop. First place, everybody here, this land doesn't even belong to them. And they're just developing, scraping their, right here where the Facts of Life that in Peekskill, where St. Mary's was up on a mountain, they're up there blasting. There's places I live in the town I've never been in. They're blasting. They don't care. Every place they can put a building, that's what they're doing. And your children will have no place to play. I've seen that happen. Kids have they'll be together and they'll have a ball because they're in an apartment. They're making a one bedroom and a two bedroom like it's 900 bedrooms. It's not. You're crowded. You can't. You're like sardines. But this development that's going on all over, it's insane. So who's benefiting by this? You can't find a part-time job because some immigrant got your job. They're all over the place. I was up across the river yesterday, and I'm meeting people that are from somewhere else. It's not the American people. Those people who got those jobs that what he's talking about, that's one thing. But the people who don't have those, that's another thing. So there's a big poverty thing going on. You know, so it's just development all down the Hudson River, all across the river. We can see Manhattan. They're building on rock over there just so they can see Manhattan. You know, I mean, it just doesn't even make any sense. But this development has to stop. They're tearing down good buildings to put up another building. You go through a town where they tore down a hospital to put something else similar to that building. So where's all this money coming from in this so-called development and everything? And nobody, the regular people are not going to benefit. When you live in a town where you didn't have to go outside that town to get any appliances or anything, now you got to leave the town to go to Walmart or Home Depot or Kmart or whatever it is that to get what you had. You had it right there in the town. So the people, the politicians, and those developers never cared about the regular people. They just tore it all down, and so now a town has big rolls in the street because all that's coming through that street is Walmart trucks and Home Depot trucks and all that. And that so who's taking care of that? No, it's a deep thing. Thank you very much.
Well, hold on, Rashid. Let's figure out how your analysis fits with what we are trying to accomplish, which is to see a possible way around it in terms of getting your act and everybody trying to get our acts together. Charles?
Sure. I'll touch on development and then the question of immigrants taking jobs. So in the case of development, I live in Manhattan, and I used to live north of Yoroshid up in Dutchess County and then in Columbia County. And I have some experience actually with land development and also home development. It is in an environment such as the one we're in, where interest rates are artificially depressed, that creates speculative mania, where people without a lot of capital but connections, particularly political connections, can score the money they need to do these projects, eyesore projects that you speak of. And I quite agree. You know, from actual personal experience suffering the negative effects, it is a really damaging thing to go in and cut down and blast the top of a hill or a mountain. That is a very dangerous thing to do because of the weather we have, the snow, the rain, et cetera, you get the washout suddenly. It's very damaging for erosion. It changes all sorts of things. Now, normally in New York State and in Peekskill, there are multiple government authorities, both state and local, that review these types of development projects. And one can only guess that maybe, you know, the process in your area may be corrupt. So politically connected developers are getting projects through perhaps that don't really make that much sense. So that's, you know, that's a set of issues that I quite agree. You know, I you look at how these, particularly in the Northeast and the Midwest, these old established towns with deep roots and interesting histories are being hollowed out. I used to be further north than you. The closest big town was Poughkeepsie. And Poughkeepsie in the late 1800s, obviously I didn't experience that personally, but pictures of the late 1800s, it was a beautiful place downtown. And then in the 50s, it got destroyed. It was hollowed out by these ring roads, and today it's a slum in the center. It's a dangerous slum, despite the fact that lots of money has been spent around it. And I quite take your point about this whole the Walmart culture that, where it used to make sense that the site these stores closer to where the people live. Now we don't do that anymore. It's either Amazon or Walmart. So there are, unfortunately, the good and bad news is, the good news is New York is a place, it's a rich state with a lot of wealthy people and a lot of theory opportunities. That's the good news. The bad news is it's a very expensive place to live. And if I weren't here for personal reasons, I wouldn't be in New York State. It's not a great place. As far as the tax system and the business, lack of business incentives. On the question of immigration and immigrants taking jobs, what I personally observe further north than you is you have unscrupulous employers who are willing to hire illegal immigrants. And those illegal immigrants are, they don't care. They're very happy to get a cash payment from the employer if they work, and also whatever subsidies they may be able to get it from the government. They don't care that they're not being paid fairly. And of course, people who are, you know, full-time citizens here, who have to be paid lawfully, you know, they're at a major league disadvantage. And so, I don't know whether the particulars of Donald Trump's immigration plan make sense or not make sense. But I think the paramount duty of our political leaders and then the people who vote is to make sure that the government protects Americans. That's what we have to do first. And if we have a skewed system that encourages, as I say, unscrupulous employers to hire illegal immigrants in place of deserving Americans who need jobs, that's a problem that really needs to be fixed.
But it hasn't been fixed over centuries, actually. And Peekskill, in particular, and along the Hudson River, was notorious as mafia enclaves. That's where they ran the construction business out of. Also, because, I mean, the construction business was rife with bribery, extortion, crime, murder, all kinds of horrible crimes. And only of late do we see the racial aspect of it, in a sense, because it's so riddled with exclusion, racism, prejudice, that put a whole workforce and the potential workforce completely out of the running. And this was kept secret for a long time, but every city, I think, would have something like it. We just covered 2 weeks ago the 100th anniversary of the slaughter in East St. Louis, which had a lot to do with work and building construction jobs. We had in New York City in 1919 a major conflict resulting in hundreds of deaths over who will get the work. At the time, ironically, that the Statue of Liberty was being installed. This was the raging issue. So this is something that also coincides. I just wanted to add to Rashid's point. This is something that coincides with the racial animus that was prolonged by law and custom. Peekskill, as you know, well, You know the history of Peekskill and race riots. It had to do with jobs. So, and the jobs were in, a large percentage of the jobs were in construction of homes. We had situations where people systematically were driven out of the town and relegated. If you were black, you were relegated to going down as close to the river as possible in very inferior housing. And now they're trying to take the housing away because it's now considered prime real estate property to be on the river. So it has it's a mixture of governmental policy, social policy, because that was the policy. You couldn't be black or Latino or anything and live safely in that city for a long, long time. And now that there is a feeling that there's money in development, we're seeing a kind of a very sluggish change in that. But I don't know that it would be fast enough to bring equity to the city of Peekskill and other places like that.
Certainly a difficult problem.
Thank you, Rashid, though, just to say, for bringing that to our attention. I appreciate your comments. That brings us to the end of the program today. Charles, what do you think about, as things are progressing on all these different levels, does that constitute, in your view, an organized, even if it's accidental, but an organized change in our society?
Well, I think we're weaning ourselves off the view that experts across many different fields actually know what they're talking about. I mean, we've had in this new millennium, it's now 17 years into it. Some could argue 18, if you count 2000. You know, where, in what zones of our living do we feel that the experts actually truly understand what's going on, whether it's, you know, the medical field, you know, situation of ex-wife is dealing with a very difficult cancer situation. And, you know, the conclusion we get from some of the best doctors is they don't really know what they're doing. In finance, doesn't seem they know what they're doing, regulation, government, et cetera. So I don't know that it's organized. I just think that, you know, we're growing up. We're opening our eyes. Perhaps the internet and programs like yours are allowing people to connect, think more deeply, and identify the real problems. And I hope we're getting closer to actually trying to fix them, particularly in this great country. There's so much to offer those who are living here.
But I quite agree that it seems that the leadership is coming from the people who know what the problem is. Problems are, and are trying to get the cooperation of the leadership to fix them. But it doesn't seem that it's an easy task so far.
I agree. And, you know, and we always have to remember that the people put in charge of fixing problems get out of put out of a job once they fix the problem. So there's a natural human attitude to say, oh, well, maybe I should take an extra 10 years to fix this problem.
Yeah. And then by then, I've retired with a very handsome pension. Well, thank you, Charles, for being with us today and being available to the callers and the listeners to answer their questions and their concerns. I really appreciate that. And, of course, we'll continue watching how things develop on all these different levels and what they mean to us and for us in terms of changing our habits in order to survive. We have to become very, very much in love with ourselves and our interests, because these folks don't know what they're doing. And whatever it is they are doing, they're not doing it well. And that is causing enormous ripple effects across the country and even internationally. What is this era that we're in? Why is it that we have policymakers so vengeful, so out of touch, and so slow to make the right moves, despite the fact that, you know, by votes and other means, people have been registering on them the need to move quickly on some of these concerns. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Anytime. Stay tuned. Thank you.
Thank you. Stay tuned. Coming up next is Dr. Jack Rasmus. You really want to stay tuned for that program. And you can reach me at Expanding Mind. Where was I? Expanding Mind is up next. You want to stay tuned for that program. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. I really hope that this helps put our focus back on the essential question of getting to work. Don't just listen, but apply the information and the knowledge that you're getting, even in the smallest way. You set aside a little bit of money on a regular basis, and you pretend it isn't there. And then one day when you need it, there you go. So small incremental changes are very important to make, and these will represent major victories in our lives, in that we push the government away, a little bit further away from us, and we take center stage in our own lives. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye.